I think surrendering when I had nothing left, as sad as it was also a very defining moment for me, because it's a moment that I am reminded of in little ways. And we're like, whoa, like this could have all not happened.
Welcome to the Heroic Minds podcast, where we discover how to get out of our own way, unleash the full capability of our mind, become the hero of our story, and a hero for other people.
From an evolutionary perspective, we've evolved to manage threatening encounters.
I want to do everything in my ability to help them, but they make the call.
We have to do it in a way that doesn't just assume that going faster is going to be the cure-all.
When you suffer and then you come out of it on the other side, you stand a little taller, your voice doesn't shake anymore, your eyes are always up.
Sorry to depress you guys. Self-doubt is par for the course. It's just how you choose to deal with them, react to them, or not react to them.
A little tough love goes a long way, and high expectation also goes a long way. The more you expect of someone, the more they'll do.
I have to keep moving forward. No good comes from going back.
I don't need red tape. I'm not into rules. I'm not into regulation. I'm just going to do this.
Welcome back to the Heroic Minds podcast. On today's episode, we have Victoria Arlen. Victoria is an author, ESPN host, gold medalist, and much more. Victoria's life drastically changed in 2006 at the tender age of 11 when she developed two rare conditions known as transverse myelitis and acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, which in very simple terms are inflammation of both the spinal cord and the brain, which very, very rarely occur at the same time. This was an incredibly rare scenario, and Victoria quickly lost the ability to speak, eat, walk, and move. She slipped into a vegetative state in which doctors had written her off as a lost cause. Victoria spent nearly 4 years locked inside her own body, completely aware of what was going on, just unable to move or communicate. Doctors believed there was little hope. She could hear doctors say to her family, it may be better to give up. Nor she or her family gave in. In 2010, after almost 4 years, she began the nearly impossible fight back to life, learning how to speak, eat, and move all over again. Victoria went on to exceedingly defy the odds and not only recover, but has since become an accomplished motivational speaker, television host, and swimmer. Her swimming resume includes 3 silvers and a gold medal from the London 2012 Paralympic Games, as well as multiple world, American, and Pan-American records. In April 2015, Victoria made the transition from professional athlete to sportscaster and joined ESPN. In the spring of 2016, Victoria defied yet another odd, and after spending nearly a decade in a wheelchair, paralyzed from the waist down, was able to learn how to take one step after another. And eventually, not only did she learn how to walk, but within a year and a half, in the fall of 2017, she learned to dance as a contestant of Dancing with the Stars. Victoria puts this entire journey in the first person in her incredible book, Locked In. Now, we didn't have time to get to everything that I wanted to on this episode because the book is absolutely jam-packed with incredible messages and stories. In this episode, I don't even know where to start. I think the biggest takeaway, because we talk about so many different things, is that old idea of hope and how powerful that hope can be when every single person in your life is saying it's time to give up, and for some reason there's a light burning inside you that allows you to keep going. I think that's what this episode's about. And a beautiful quote that I know from Barack Obama is that hope is that stubborn thing that insists, despite all the evidence of the contrary, that something better awaits us, as long as we have the courage to keep working, to keep pushing, to keep fighting. Now, before we hop into this episode, we always give a shout out to our absolute best friends, the reliable, incredible True Local, that treat their customers like gold. That's True Local, TRULOCAL.ca. High quality meat, locally sourced, individually packaged, thrown onto dry ice and dropped at your doorstep in recyclable packaging that now offers not just frozen meat, but frozen vegetables and frozen fruit. One of my favorite parts of TrueLocal is there are zero hidden fees. There's no terms, no agreements, no negotiations. You decide exactly when you want your box to arrive. And when you don't want it to arrive, you simply put that in your profile. I don't want a box for a couple months. Nothing happens at all. You just go back on and let them know when you want another box to arrive. No complications, just incredible customer service and incredible food. If you want to give them a try, use my discount code HEROICMINDS25, all capital letters, to get $25 off a regular size box and $10 off a personal size box. Before we hop into this episode, I encourage you to check out the description of this episode because the link to Victoria's book, Locked In, is in the description, and I encourage you to purchase a copy. Again, there are so many topics in this book that we didn't discuss, that we didn't cover, because there is just not enough time. So I encourage you to check it out and check out Victoria's social media. It's full of optimism, full of inspiration. So again, link is in the description of this episode. All right, here we go.
Yeah. So I was probably, I'm one of four. I have three brothers. So I grew up in a hockey family as well. So we all learned at like the age of three. And so for me growing up, I was always just trying to keep up with them. I loved sports. I very matter of factly told my mom when I was five, I was going to be an Olympian and win a gold medal. And so I think for me, I was the picture of health. And I think I just had these lofty goals and really saw no way of not achieving them. And so I think for me to be the one that gets sick out of everyone, that's, I think, what was so shocking to people. I mean, obviously no one, you don't want anyone to get sick, but for it to be me wasn't even more so, because I was the kid who brought like organic vegetables to school. Like I was very health conscious from a young age. But it started slow. Like I think it was the beginning of fifth grade where I developed asthma. Then I would get sick every couple of weeks. So my immune system was compromised. And I was the kid who never got sick. I think I got an ear infection, and that was the most exciting health thing I dealt with. And every other week or two, I was in the doctor's office for pneumonia, the flu, asthma, like all these weird things, or I would get these fainting spells. And I would bounce back, and I was still doing well in school, well in sports. And so it really wasn't concerning. Like, I think my mom was like, the stars are just misaligned, but she seems like she's fine. And I'm very stubborn, so I really don't like to sit still. So even when I like could finally start to feel better, I would be right back outside or back playing or going to school. And then on April 29th, I woke up in 2006. I woke up with this really severe pain on my right side. And that was when everything kind of changed. That was when it was a lot harder to get off the couch, and kind of doctors thought it was appendicitis. And then within 3 months of that initial kind of wake up and something's not right, I was unresponsive in a vegetative state. Very quickly, very quick decline.
What was this experience like? Was it similar to sleep paralysis? If people wanted to try and understand exactly what the state is that you were in, how would you word it?
So I actually try. So I do a lot of speaking, motivational speaking. And so the beginning of my speech, I kind of try to paint the picture, and I just basically tell people, like, imagine being trapped, just completely trapped, whatever that looks like for you. For some, it's like a room with no windows or an elevator, or they're laying in bed and they can't move. Like, just imagine that feeling of being trapped and like trying to scream for help and no one can hear you. And that's basically kind of what it was. But it was like it was like someone was closing the prison door slowly. So I was watching things deteriorate, but not fully understanding. I was 11 too. So I really didn't have, you know, the adult, oh my gosh, something is seriously wrong. You know, obviously my parents did. For me, I was kind of like, hey, why can't I grab that glass of water? Why am I foot dragging? Why am I having trouble? Why is no one understanding what I'm saying? And so there was like this internal like fight, if you will, of like not knowing why I can't just go outside and play with my friends. So I'd say it's like whatever you define as feeling trapped, that's basically what it felt like. But I was trapped within my own body.
In parts of your book, you would say that you were able to see, but you couldn't move your eyes, to the point where even the muscles in your eyes weren't working. So you were stuck looking at whatever was directly in front of you at any given moment through that journey.
Yeah, exactly.
And so at that young age, it's an unfortunate comparison. And I just, when I was reading the book, it made me think, you know, a lot of people are somewhat upset with being trapped in their own mind today.
Yeah.
Saying I can't get out of the classic saying, I can't get out of my own head. And that's even from a sport performance point of view, which I know you're very familiar with. At 11 years old, were you able to develop any type of coping mechanism that you're able to utilize today through that experience?
Yeah. So I think, I was in this vegetative state for like 4 years. And so from 11 to 15, I really had to dive in. And I remember, because doctors were constantly telling my parents to say goodbye. They were constantly telling my parents I wasn't going to make it. And if I did make it, I'd be a vegetable the rest of my life, or I wouldn't be a contributing member of society. Actually, that was a really popular statement that was used, which I feel like fuels a lot of what I do now indirectly. But yeah, so I remember kind of having this moment. I was about 3 years in, or not 3 years. I was a little, like, I was halfway into this. And I remember thinking, this isn't changing. I'm not, like, obviously I'm still here, but I don't know necessarily how much time I have here. So to avoid going down this path of negative thinking, which got really scary and really dark very quickly, I decided to kind of make a declaration and give myself a challenge to list the things I had to be grateful for every morning. And so every morning I woke up, my first thing on my list was, well, I woke up today, I'm alive, you know, and you're probably, you know, I think most people are thinking, when you start your gratitude list with the fact that you're alive and you woke up, you're really scraping the bottom of the barrel to find some good news. And I absolutely was, but it was like a major one on the plus column. And then from there, that list kept growing. And by doing that, I found it really became a lifeline for me, but it allowed me to shift my perspective, which allowed hope to kind of come in and me start to think, what if I did get better? What if I did come out of this? What would I want to do? Where would I want to go? What are the things I'd want to achieve? What are the things I'd want to say? And so I kind of just mentally, and maybe it's because, you know, I was naive. Maybe it's because I really had nothing to lose at that point, because I'd lost everything, that I was like, well, I want to be prepared for when that, you know, when that moment comes. And I have an incredible family, and they set up a hospital room in our living room and just loved me and took care of me. And so I was like, I want to first say thank you to them and how much I love them. And so I think for me, I just decided to try to just get excited about what was to come. And I think sometimes, like you said, where we get stuck in our head, we get so stuck in situations that we don't think we're ever going to get out. And it's like, well, yeah, but it's not going to last forever. It may feel like forever, but by focusing your perspective on not the challenges and things weighing you down, but the things you do have and the things you have to look forward to are really crucial in like shifting your perspective.
You just made me think you're only stuck in your own head if the thoughts aren't the ones that you want.
Yeah, there's a victim and victory voice. That's what I always say. Those are like the
100%.
But the victim voice is way louder than the victory voice.
That's how I've. So if you're going to talk about your talks that you do, I'll quote myself as well in saying, yeah, one thing I say is, you know, you can listen to the chorus of voices screaming, you can't handle this, or you decide to listen to that lone whisper that says heroes are born in challenge. And so similar to what you're saying, I just find it fascinating. We all say we're stuck in our own head, but if you turn those thoughts into things that are a little more optimistic, maybe things that you can leverage, thoughts that you can leverage a little more, all of a sudden it's okay to be stuck in your own head then.
Flip the switch, yeah.
If we quickly back up for a second, I think one part that in the book that was, I mean, I would stop every second of the book to bring something up, but again, we don't have time for that, is one of the issues that happened is that you actually dropped off at a psych ward accidentally. Like, I know that was a brief part of the book, but that's a massive experience of almost a barbaric treatment from what.
Yeah, it was unfortunately one of those situations where doctors at this one particular hospital had such egos the size of a skyscraper that they didn't want to admit they didn't know what was wrong. And because with what I had was very treatable in the early stages, but they misdiagnosed it. And unfortunately, back in 2006, they didn't know a lot about these two conditions versus what they know now. Like, they also know way more about the brain and all those, and, you know, inflammation and encephalitis. And so, so it was such a, I mean, we as a family, like, we are just like, how did this like happen? But it's not an uncommon thing. And that is something that actually recently I encountered a family, and they were coming to my family's facility, which we'll get into later, Project Walk. And they were saying how before they got the proper diagnosis, this same hospital in particular tried to say there was a pain management and physical therapy center. So it was basically an unmarked psych ward. And it's basically doctors throw, you know, trick parents into bringing their kids there because they can't figure out what's wrong and they don't want to admit it. And they're just figure, well, we can snap them out of it. And it was a nurse that went to this family behind the scenes and was like, hey, you don't want to send your kid there. And they're like, well, why not? Like, we can't help them. Like, they can't walk, they're having issues. And she's like, yeah, she's like, I can't say too much, but I still to this day cannot get over the fact that there was this little girl over a decade ago that the same thing happened. We watched it happen and it was horrific what happened. And, you know, she managed to recover and all this stuff. And I think they had read my book, and this woman like, who is she? Who is she? And the woman's like, well, I can't tell you who she is, but if you happen to watch Dancing with the Stars a few years ago, and obviously there's like, you know, thanks. But my point being is it unfortunately is not an uncommon thing. And it was a thing that going through it was horrific, and going through it to have those be kind of my last memories, if you will, of being relatively conscious was horrific. But it's at the same time, you know, you're as a parent, you're trying to help your child. And my parents, once they figured it out, it was a whole thing where another hospital, lawyers, people had to get involved. And they literally, if they had not gotten me out, like, the doctors were like, they would have killed her. Like, that is how dire it got. But that's just a kind of behind the scenes barbaric thing that is still happening, because they just fail to admit that they don't know. And that if we snap people out of it, they'll be fine. Well, no, there's something's wrong. And even in my plight too, and like, even I've spoken to a few hospitals about this. I was like, even if someone was, you know, mentally unstable or having issues, that is not how you treat someone. You need to treat someone with love, kindness, respect. Like, that is not how you should treat anyone. No one deserves that. Like, treat others the way you wish to be treated. But yes, it is a very surreal. I always say to people, like, if you can get through chapter 3, just watch out. Like, you need like a good snack, maybe a glass of wine. I don't know.
Yeah, totally. You really, really do. And I think it's,
I almost left that chapter out, actually.
Wow. I mean, I could see you debating that. I think the one thing I loved about your book is it was not science dense. You weren't pulling it. It was just such a powerful story, which I want to get into next on the religious spiritual side of things. Is the way you wrote it was that, like, you're sitting there buckled in with you almost as you read it. It's fascinating. And now, you know, you briefly just said, do unto others as you want done to you, a bit of a religious spin on that for sure. And in the book, you talk about praying a lot, and I'm on this podcast, I talk about it in whatever sense it comes out as, and that's whether it's spiritual, whether it's a belief in something that just maybe the individual believes in and no one else does, like, who really knows? And I'm open-minded to it. And so I'm curious, you know, you said you prayed as a child to feel better. And when you prayed, when you were in that darkness, what did that experience do for you?
I think that experience gave me comfort in knowing that, you know, hopefully someone is listening to me. And so hopefully, you know, God is listening to me. And I knew, I had just this knowing that the only way I was going to get out of this was a miracle, because the scans were bad, the tests were bad, my health was really bad. There was no hope. Like, there literally was no hope. And so, so I think for me, looking up was a lot more comforting than looking down and planning my funeral, which I had to do a few times and say goodbye. But I think I never wanted to. I didn't want to. I wasn't ready to die, you know, and I had things I wanted to do. And so I think finding comfort in my faith and just knowing that there was a bigger purpose and that for some reason I'm going through this, but there will be good that will come out of it, I think gave me a lot of comfort to keep going. Because there was a lot of days where I just wanted to scratch my nose, or sometimes I wanted to scream, or sometimes I just wanted to have a second of just freedom. I was just this prisoner in my body. And like dying is very painful. And so when you have just this 4-year, like up and down, you get tired. And so I think for me, praying was kind of a reminder that there was something greater, and that, you know, maybe, just maybe, you know, I will get that miracle.
On two separate occasions in the book, and I don't know if there were more that you didn't include in the book, but as you just said, there were two times that you go in quite deeply on where you were opening yourself basically to death. And again, this is where I forget how young you are. You're not even 18 years old. And you have that voice in your head. You're talking to yourself, almost surrendering to the most unknown, scary part of life at this young age. And you're all alone. That's one thing you made clear. And you said that specifically, I'm not even around people, when you really thought it was happening. And I wonder what your opinion is on the connection to that and power in that moment. And this might be a weird question. I think I do a lot of research now into the hero's journey, and a lot of what the hero's journey would say is it's people that are surrendering and letting a certain part of themselves die off to become something stronger and something greater. And I wonder, does that resonate with you in any way, that you were able to surrender fully to one of the most daunting things in life, and somehow there was a bit of power in it?
Absolutely. I think more so now I see it as that. I think at the time, things were so bad. The first experience I had was at that psych ward. And I remember just being like, I'm done. Like, it's bad enough I'm in this situation, but now I'm getting abused and mistreated and I can't even scream for help or defend myself. And so I think from that one was just, that seemed like my only option. That seemed like the best case scenario. And I think, but I do believe that surrender is powerful, but I also, even as a kid, was like, I don't know how I can come back from this. Like, I don't know how I can bounce back or be okay after this. You know, it was so bad for so long. And so I think it was a combination of those two. But then I think at one point too, it was just surrendering and knowing like, I can't control this. Like, this is completely out of my control. Do I want to die? No. But do I want to keep doing this for the rest of my life? Probably not. You know, so I think it was one of those things where it was okay at that point, because I was just so tired. And I think sometimes you surrender the most, I feel like, when you're tired and when you just have nothing left. And so I think surrendering when I had nothing left, as sad as it was also a very defining moment for me, because it's a moment that I'm reminded of in little ways, and we're like, whoa, like, this could have all not happened, and here I am. And so, yeah, I'd say so, but I think it took me a long time to understand that. I think for a while, I was just like, wow, it's really sad.
Right, for sure. It's, yeah, I found that I couldn't even imagine at that age. I thought that was another point in the book where I had to stop and just sit there and think, holy smokes, like, you can't articulate it, right? Another part in the book where I was sitting, like, there are some times, I'll admit, where I'm almost gripping the book a little harder than I should, because of I'm resonating with you and sort of, in a way, I don't want to say directly feel what you felt, but you write it in a way that you do give the reader a chance to feel that lack of control and no one hearing you, all those things you talk about. There was a part where you could hear the doctors telling your parents that you could die, and all the negative updates for your parents, and you're laying there hearing everything, not able to move or say anything or respond. How does one channel that frustration? Because this is a moment where I'm like ripping onto the book, trying to hold on. How do you try and cope with that?
I think a whole lot of faith, but I think a lot of stubbornness. And I think for me, I remember just thinking, no, this is not how my story ends. My story doesn't end in a hospital bed here. Like, my story is going to end in a really cool way. And I remember just having this urgency that I had more things I wanted to do. And so I think for me, like, I listened and I was like, oh, I had a moment. I did have moments where I was like, are they right? Is it true? But then I was like, no, I do not want to die without being able to say thank you to my family. I love them. Drive a car. Like, mind you, I was, you know, 12, 13, 14 at this point. So driving a car was really cool. Like, all these things I wanted to do. And so I remember just being like, no, this is like, I remember having like a mental temper tantrum with myself and being like, this is not how my story ends. Like, there is more I want to do. And so I was like, who are they to depict what I'm capable of? If I want to live, I'm going to sure as heck fight until the very last moment to live and fight to come back to my family and fight to even just have a moment with them and say thank you and I love them. And so I remember it ignited something in me, and it's kind of followed this whole journey of like, when someone tells me I can't do something, I'm kind of like, well, I'll show you. I mean, I'm one of triplets and I have an older brother. I have all boys in my family. Like, I have always been brought up that way, that like, you just do it. When the going gets tough, you toughen up and get going. And so I think that was just what I kept feeling. And I was kind of like, well, who are you to tell me what I'm capable of? And then I just kind of decided, and I also just didn't want my parents to bury me. I'm the only girl. I can't leave my mom by herself. So there's a lot of like, there's child thoughts, and there was just like these ridiculously grown up thoughts going through my head. But I think the combination of the two created this like path of proving them wrong.
Yeah, it seems that way. And I mean, it's almost like you develop and mature on your own. I mean, you missed 4 years of a lot of growing up and interacting with the world. You missed all that, yet you were still able to mature and grow up. I find that alone fascinating in itself. You know, you think development comes from this constant interaction with the world, but it appears as if you were able to have that all in your own mind.
Absolutely. Sometimes there's power in sitting back and watching and observing.
Totally.
And it's very humbling when you can't even scratch your nose. Very humbling.
I can't even imagine. I try to, and I really can't. You we've talked about your parents a couple times now, your family and their support. How did they make, that was such a long time. How did they maintain that? Not only they're not just doing it. It's not partial support. Like, it is full support. It's, and they maintain that the entire time. What is it that, if you reflect back, what is it that kept them going? I almost wish your mom was here so I could ask her personally. But, you know, it wasn't that they were, okay, let's go see, you know, Victoria again. Let's go see. And no, it was like they were there fully and emotionally bought in, and they were really there. What was it that kept them engaged like that?
So we actually had this conversation not too long ago, as I'm working on a new project, and I asked them just kind of point blank. I was like, what was it that, because everyone, it was my mom, my dad, my brothers, like, they just had such an unshakable like hope and faith that things would be okay. And from setting up the hospital room in the living room to even if I was in the hospital, they were with me. And my mom just said, she's like, honestly, the idea of losing you was so terrifying that every day we had you, even though you were in a vegetative state, you're still our child, you're still Victoria, and we're going to love you and give you the best life possible. And she's like, same with your brothers. They were just excited you were alive. They were excited that you were still with us. And my dad too, he's like, you were still you. He's like, yes, you couldn't talk to us. Yes, we didn't know, you know, that you were in there, but you were you. And just the idea of still having you was such a blessing to them, that like when they were supposed to say goodbye and they said goodbye multiple times, they were like, just the fact that we had you was all that mattered. They're like, you're still part of our family. You're still our little girl. And it was funny because parents at the hospital would go to my parents and be like, why are you here all the time? Like, why are you bringing her home? And my mom's like, it's my child. My dad's like, this is our child. And my brother's like, this is our sister. And so they all just were like, the fact that you were still with us, every day that you were still with us, we were happy, we were elated, and we would have taken care of you the rest of your life. They're like, you're a kid, we love you. Like, so I think they just had that. And I think they held on to gratitude as well, that I was still here. And yes, it wasn't ideal. It wasn't what anyone pictured, but all my brothers and my parents were just like, you were still here. And like, if it was any one of us, we would have wanted the same thing, to just be loved and be still a part of the family. They just brought the world to me when I was really sick.
That is so cool. I love that approach, that they brought the world to you. That's cool. You also had a word that came up a lot in the book, and that was love. And one thing I want to continue to dive into as I build this podcast is the idea of love, not in the romantic sense that we know it best, I think, in society today, but in, you know, at one point in your book, you talked about fiercely. They loved you fiercely. And I want to unpack that. When you say love that way, like, that doesn't think to me of, you know, gushy, light some candles, love with family. It's a fierce love. And what does that mean to you?
It was a fierce love that led to a fearlessness with my family, of not living in a state of fear constantly when every obstacle and challenge was in front of them that allowed them to do that. And they all decided that if we're scared, and if we get, I mean, mind you, they were scared and there was moments, but I think this fierce love that they had and that we all have for one another translated into this fearlessness of, okay, for her, we're going to believe in her, we're going to help her, we are going to do whatever it takes to keep her here. And so I think that really gave them this strength to keep going for all those years and to keep fighting and keep believing. And all my family made that decision. They were like, we are from a fiercely loving family, but I think that translated into this fearlessness of, okay, we can't go down this path. We can't go down what the next year will look like, the next 10 years will look like. We have right now, she's with us right now. What can we do to keep her with us? And that's what they did.
Another example of that love was when the priest came in to see you, and you pointed out, I know we kind of touched on it already, in a sense of, you're not stuck in your own head if you're controlling those thoughts, and they're optimistic thoughts or thoughts that are helping you. Everyone else speaks of sorrow and sadness and is afraid to offer hope that may not be realized, was something powerful you said in the book. And I think that's so true. It stopped me in my tracks when I read that. And I thought, when things are bad, people love to reiterate and repeat that things are bad, things are bad. No one wants to offer that hope and be the odd one out saying, well, wait a second, maybe this could happen. So what was it like when the priest came to see you?
It was powerful. I mean, I think it still blows my mind to this day how being a negative Nelly is more of a trend than being positive and being hopeful. You know, just being negative is more comforting for people and stuff too. And so when Father Bosch came, and I still keep in touch with Father Bosch, fun fact, like he has been someone who's followed along my journey and just does amazing work. So I try to support his missions as well, but he just had hope. And he had hope, and we actually spoke a couple months ago, and he brought that back up, and he goes, I just decided to believe in the impossible. And he goes, and that's what faith is all about, is believing in the impossible, believing in the unseen, believing that there's something greater beyond what you can see. And that's obviously the live by faith, not by sight. And so I think doctors and experts were seeing a very compromised, frail, you know, kid with these severe neurological conditions with irreversible damage. And that's what they saw. And so when Father Bosch came in, he saw someone who, yes, was very sick, yes, was very ill, but there was a whole lot of hope and love in that room. And with that, amazing things can happen and miracles can happen. And he said that, he was like, there will be a miracle. And my mom and dad, as much as, you know, every scenario and situation and expert said to believe otherwise, we're like, we believe. And sometimes you just need, like, I love the I love how it's like sometimes you just need a little mustard seed of faith and hope to ignite something and to hold on to that little mustard seed. And so I think they did. I think they had their little mustard seed and really, I mean, it took a while, but really had that miracle, if you will. And then it just kind of transpired into it.
And as you're saying that, it makes me think that there's also a part of believing in something that may seem impossible is a lot of fun, especially when you're with other people, right? For lack of a better way to explain it. Yeah. It's like, let's come together on something that's impossible. And you had your team, which was your family. And I would hope other healthcare professionals around you too, that let's buy into this miracle and believe it together. Yeah. And I think that's really cool. I mean, probably a reason that religion has survived so many years and these stories have, because you have a close knit group of people or tribe that stick together on a belief together. I think that's powerful. But the way you said it made me think of the fun side to it. That's cool.
Well, it's exciting to think for me, that gave me such joy just thinking about the things I'd be able to do and what I would want to do when I get out of this situation. And I think my parents, they would have moments because they're like, we missed you. We missed your voice. We missed your silliness. And so they're like, I wonder what she'd be thinking about this. And I wonder what she'll think about, you know, and what she'll say about this. And like, my mom gave me bangs when I was really sick, which is a whole other level of trauma that we don't need to get into. My first real sentence to her was, you gave me bangs. Like, what have you done? Like, I gave you a haircut. And I was like, oh my God. But stuff like that. And so I think when you do that, it is fun. And I think you have to find that fun. You also have to find the humor. You have to find reasons to smile, because if you don't laugh, you'll cry. And so even in like the depths, my family still found joy. My family still found, you know, humor and everything. And people would come over and be so flabbergasted at like my brothers or my dad cracking jokes, my mom cracking jokes. And like, they were like, wait, why are you doing that? Because they want to act all doom and gloom. And my mom's like, if Victoria's in there, she would want us to be cracking jokes. Yeah. She would be the one cracking the jokes. Like, we're not going to sit around like it's a funeral. She's not dead. Like, she's right here. And so I think that was like such a saving grace, was that humor side. And we all still have a very twisted sense of humor. But they were like, we just had to find joy. We had to find joy in what would be described as the anti-joy of a situation. But they're like, we had to just find joy, and we had to find reasons to smile, because if there was a slightest chance that you were in there, that's exactly what you would have wanted. And I was like, yeah, that's exactly what I would have wanted.
When I opened up this podcast, I said that it was about hope. I wanted to lay the landscape of exactly what I mean leading up to the moment of our next topic in this episode, which is when Victoria's mother, for the first time in 4 years, realizes that Victoria's in there and they communicate for the first time. So before that moment, this is earlier in the book, this is a moment where Victoria was contemplating life and death. I feel myself falling deeper and deeper in an ocean of despair. I struggle to get to the surface, but I'm continually pulled under. The waves are too much and I can't swim. I cannot reach the surface. I'm drowning. I want to be free. My daydreams are fading. It's been a long time since I was able to drift away to my place on the lake. 4 years earlier, I fought against my wish to die, but I don't even have the little strength I had back then. I've got nothing left. I'm caught between dying and surviving. I can feel my body shutting down. Finally, I can be at peace. Finally, I can be free. Now, if we move forward a little bit further in the book to the moment we're about to discuss, I'll read another piece from Victoria's book. A chemical in the sleeping medication has somehow interrupted the neurotransmitter that causes my seizures. For the first time in a year, I am relaxed and not in pain. My headache goes away and I'm free. Free to try harder to break out of this prison that is my body. I need a miracle, a true miracle. But miracles are hard to come by. Please, God, blink, blink, blink. Wait, I'm blinking. I'm blinking. One blink, double blink, triple blink. Now let's try something tricky. Look left. Now look right. Yes, my eyes. I have control of my eyes back. I'm no longer just staring blankly. Mom, Mom. Oh, wait, I don't have my voice yet. Here's Victoria diving further into that moment.
I mean, it was amazing. Probably undoubtedly like the most incredible moment in my life. And I had been having, at this point, we've been almost 4 years into the vegetative state. And so I was having seizures for 20 hours a day. And so the doctors, you know, I was failing very quickly and my body was just not, you can't sustain that many seizures back to back to back for an extended period of time. And so the doctors were like, we need to sedate her. We need to knock her out. We need to give her body a break. And so nothing was working. And they gave me a medication and it didn't sedate me. It didn't knock me out, but it stopped the seizures because they figured that they found out eventually that there was a neurotransmitter from the encephalomyelitis that was misfiring. And so this medication in particular somehow stopped it. And so it was kind of an on the whim decision that ended up giving me a window. It was kind of like, kind of like the window I needed where I didn't know how much time I had without these seizures. So I was like, okay, I got to do something, make a noise, move something, wiggle a finger, blink my eyes. Like I got to do something to let, you know, my mom know that I'm in there. And so it's kind of like my game time moment where I was like, this is it. Like, this is the time, like you need to go for it. And so I realized I had my eyes. And so I was moving around and looking up and down and realizing, okay, this is good. And then I realized I could blink. And so I've always been told, my dad, since I was little, was like, you were a baby with a big head and these big brown eyes. So I have very expressive eyes, but for those 4 years, my eyes were fixed or they were rolled back or they were glossed over. So you didn't really see that. And so obviously they're back in action. And, my mom walks in and I'm tracking her and she's walking around and I'm just like staring at her. Now, if anyone's like looking at you, like you're going to notice at some point, you would hope. And so, so she's kind of picks up on that and walks closer. And then she realizes like, I'm looking right at her. And she, you know, ended up telling me later on that that was the moment she knew I was in there, even before I blinked. Is she's like, I just saw you for the first time in 4 years. I saw you. I saw your eyes. She goes, I knew you were in there. And then she obviously asked, you know, she wanted to double check, but like, you know, if you can hear me, can you blink once, blink twice, just blink. And I just started blinking. And that was single-handedly the greatest achievement in my eyes, my entire life, because that was the breakthrough moment. That was the moment. All it takes is a blink. And that was the moment to most be like, well, she's just blinking. She's not talking. Well, no, it was blinking back. Like that was that blink of hope that I needed to fan that flame, keep coming back. And so from there, obviously she called my dad and she's hysterically crying and then my brothers. And then they just started opening up the world for me and getting on top of the seizures. The doctors got on top of the seizures. And then it was like, all right, how do we communicate with her? How do we help her, you know, come back? And then that was the turning point.
And from that turning point, that's so powerful, that blink. I couldn't imagine being in your mom's shoes for that moment. So from that point to when you got into sledge hockey, what was that process like? Was it months? Was it a year? What was that like to ultimately get to the point where you were starting to build that independence again?
Yeah. I got first, so I started coming back January of 2010 and I got put into a sled that March or April, but my dad was skating around with me and he duct taped sticks to my hand. Once again, from a hockey family, he duct taped sticks to my hand and just skated me around and was like checking me in the boards. So here I'm like, I'm still trying to figure out how to sit up and hold my head up. My mom's recording. He's just like knocking me in the boards and I'm like smiling. And I was like, Larry, like, what are you doing? And my other brothers are skating and my dad's like, well, if she wants to play this game again, she's got to kind of toughen back up. And so, so that was about March or April. And then that next fall I joined a team and loved it. I think it was, because I was going back to school, but it was the first thing I discovered, because obviously I'm in a wheelchair and the doctors are like, you're never going to walk again. And so for me to find that competitive edge again really helped me kind of find a new normal. And yeah, it was fun. And it was something that I think it was a lot different than stand-up hockey, but it was just getting out there and not having to, having an outlet and not having to just sit in my chair and figure out, you know, the world, but having an outlet to sit in a sled and just like go out and have fun. So it was a quick turnaround. It was like a six month turnaround from my initial first time in a sled.
Wow. And then you start to move into, oh, maybe I can swim. Even though at that point you only had the use, you weren't using your legs at all, right? You still didn't have the use of your legs. So you were swimming with just upper body.
Just upper body. Yeah. So I was a swimmer before I got sick. That was the sport I always told my mom I was going to win a gold medal in. And I would draw the USA cap on my little swim cap. And because there's an Olympian a few towns over who I just adored. And so I think I always was like, I'm going to be like that. And that summer of 2010, so I started to come back January, February of 2010. That summer, my brothers, I was terrified of the water at this point. My brothers were like, well, if you want to swim again, like you got to just jump in. And I was like, I can't, I don't know. Like I was still learning how to move a wheelchair. And so as lovely brothers do, they strapped on a life jacket and threw me in the water. And that was like that. I always talk about it as horrific as it sounds. It was such a learning moment for me because it got me over that fear. And sometimes the things that scare you the most, you have to jump in. And so obviously I couldn't jump in physically, but my brothers threw me in. And almost 2 years later to the day, I was in London and I won a gold medal from being thrown in. And so it was like, it was terrifying. It was scary. I felt completely foreign, but it was the greatest thing because they got me over that fear by just helping me jump in. And I just kept going. And then it was my hockey coaches that were encouraging me to get more competitive with swimming. And then that happened so quickly. And I still to this day don't really fully understand it. But it was that crucial time of just being thrown in that helped me that summer of 2010, that helped me, you know, have the courage to go back to school, get into sled hockey, go to swim and just kind of find that fire again.
Right. And you said that in the book, you said it ignited something in you. And I wondered, beyond the competitiveness, was there something else that ignited in you? What gave you, because you needed energy, you needed commitment, you needed all these things to ultimately get to the point where you yourself was thinking, oh, I could potentially win a medal one day. What was it that it ignited? And did it stick with you the whole way?
I think it ignited, it was kind of another blink moment. I think it ignited something of, wait, I could do something. I could do something really cool with this. I could do the impossible again. And so I think...
I wanted to stop and add my two cents in quickly as I've started to do more in the recent episodes. And that's just something I always talk about when I speak. And that is that I make sure people realize, especially in reference to the hero's journey, that often we get confused in thinking that to be a hero... To be considered a hero, you have to have achieved something already. You have to have overcome, slayed the dragon, overcome the challenge, and come out the other side to be considered a hero. This is what we tell ourselves, but in reality, it's really not true. And the two examples I have, one more recent being Alex Trebek, and one from history being Martin Luther King. In Martin Luther King's example, we see someone that has a dream. They don't know how they're going to get there. But they've decided to aim up. They've decided there is something we can do to improve the present circumstances. And people looked at him as a hero before anything had even happened. What was really happening is he was taking that first step into the unknown, the first step into uncertainty, which is the first step of the hero's journey. And then you're considered a hero. Now, if you look at Alex Trebek, when he was first diagnosed with cancer and came out on where I saw it was Twitter, I know it was all over different media platforms, and it was very, very early on, and he disclosed to everyone that he was going to try and fight this. He said he didn't know what kind of power this disease was going to have, but he was going to do his absolute best to fight it. again, that is that first step into the unknown, the welcoming of the uncertainty. And what does everyone else think when we heard that early on? Both examples. Well, we consider both of those courageous, incredible individuals. And further, they become people that we want to get behind and support. I think that's an important piece when we talk about hope, when we talk about dreaming, when we talk about optimism in relation to the hero's journey.
I think it ignited that. I think it really gave me this opportunity to just go for another impossible thing. Because I was like, kind of impossible things, I guess, are my jam. So, I think it ignited me to like, well, because every coach was like, you don't stand a chance. The games are a year out. And my family once again was like, if you believe you can do this, we support you 100%. Like, go for it. We will cheer you on. And that's exactly what they did in London, where there was 22,000 people and there was only about 5 that were cheering for me, which was my family, because I was up against like the poster child of Great Britain. But that was like what they did. They were like, hey, like, you got this. My parents were like, you, from where you've come, like, this is an impossible thing that is fun and is something that if you are blessed to be able to do it, great. If not, that's okay too. And as long as you're having fun and doing some good along the way. And so I think that's really what it did. I was like, well, I'm just going to go for it. I'm very superstitious. And so whenever I was on the starting block with swimming, and I actually ironically started saying this to myself right before I broke my first world record, was I'd always just say to myself, I have nothing to lose, but everything to gain. Literally nothing to lose here, but everything to gain. I think when you come so close to losing your life, when you lose every ability known, you can't possibly have anything more to lose. And you get all those back. And you know, I have moments sometimes if I'm spinning out, I'll just like scratch my nose and be like, nah, I'm good. Like, it's fine. I once made 25,000 people scratch their nose as a perspective to be like, look, if you're ever spinning out, just think about not being able to scratch your nose and how itchier it's going to get. And then scratch your nose and just remind yourself, like, I'm fine. Like, it's okay. Things are okay. If you could scratch your nose, you're good. And so I think that was, for me, that was what I did too, is I was just like, I've got nothing to lose at this point. Like, why not? Like, let's go for it. And it worked out.
I was gonna say that why not attitude led to a gold medal. And when you touch the wall on that gold medal, you, in the book, you instantly go to say it was for your family. And of course, I'm going to bring back in the hero's journey and the heroic philosophy on this one. But you, in the book, it was nothing about you. As soon as you brought that part up, it was about your family. And you talked about your coaches, and none of it was for you, even though I think part of it was. I guess, what made you put so much of that focus and value on your family in that situation?
Because I wouldn't have been there without them. And so I think when you win a gold medal, it's not about your family. It's not about you. It's about the people and the collective group that got you there. And so I think when I touched, I saw my family and was just like, we did it, you know, because I would not be alive without them. I would not be here without them. Same with my coach. And so it wasn't about me. I was kind of the vessel that did it, but it was such a bigger team that really pushed me to that level and also believed in me and pushed me on those days where it's 4:45 a.m. and it's freezing cold and I don't want to be thrown in a pool and my coach is spraying me with a hose and filling my goggles up with water to make me do a 2.5 hour practice without seeing it clearly to be ready for all of the possibilities, all the things that could go wrong or all the things that could happen. And so I never thought of it when I touched about me being like, I did it. Because I didn't do it on my own. I think if I had done it on my own, I'd be 6 feet under. You know, I didn't make it here on my own. And so I think when I touched, I was just so excited to see my family because that I dedicated all my races to them. But I also just knew the journey that we had been on because it had only been 2 years. So when London came around, I'd only been out of the vegetative state and out of the woods for a good year and a half, because even the first year, the doctor were like, well, don't get too excited. And so we really only had a solid year. We're like, are we good? Are things okay? And so I think London was such a journey, but it was like the first time where everyone could just let loose and have fun. And it was like crying tears of joy and really just being like, we're going to be okay. And I remember my parents, there's a photo of my mom and dad, and they're crying and they're in the stands, and I'd found it, and I was talking to my dad, and my mom and dad they remembered in that moment. They were like, that was when we just knew we were going to be okay, that things were going to be okay, and that we could take a breath. And same with my brothers. They felt the same way. They were like, that's when we knew, okay, we're okay now, you know? And
right, so, out of the woods. Yeah,
we're out of the woods. Yeah. So I feel like that was kind of the turning point for everyone, and then it was kind of like, holy crap, she actually did it, you know? So I think it was the combination. Yeah.
And after that race, you said it was time to start living. And I'm curious, because were you not already now on your second impossible journey? So how is that not living at that point? At what point are you living, I guess I should say?
Well, I think going back to that fear mindset too, or that fear stance, where for the first year when I was coming back, doctors were saying it was a fluke. Doctors were saying, you know, don't get too excited. You know, you're not going to get any further than this and further than this. And so I think for a good year, my family and myself too were just terrified every morning that things were going to go back to the way they were, because doctors were so flabbergasted with A, how bad it got, B, you know, how I survived it, and C, they didn't necessarily know if it would come back at that point. And so I think they were kind of like, everyone was a little like scared that there was that. They would come into my bedroom and I'd be back in a catatonic state, and I was as well. And so swimming and sled hockey gave me such an outlet to not focus on that, and to kind of find that impossible and find those were things I could control. I can't control if I were to get sick again, or if I was going to wake up in a catatonic state, but I could control, you know, my workouts and training. And so I think we all felt that way, where we all were kind of like, okay, we can take a breath now. Like we're good. And I think me as well, I was like, all right, I need to stop living in fear that this is all going to go away.
Before we move on to your next steps after swimming, while you were competing, you trained, you put your life into this, and you were extremely successful. People questioned your honesty. And there was a point where you just thought, okay, I'm going to wash my hands of this and move on, because it was just too much. What allowed you to get to that point where you were willing to push aside all that work you'd done to try and win another medal and say, okay, it's time to move on, right?
I think it was a combination of things. The fact that I was ultimately penalized for having hope. You know, I think people thought it was stupid and silly that I had hopes of walking again one day and continuing to redefine what's possible, even though every doctor was like, it's never going to happen. And so I think a lot of folks, and because I did, you know, the last Olympics before London, I was in a vegetative state fighting for my life. And so I think people are like, where did she come from? You know, she popped out of the gate. And I was like, this wasn't my plan either. Trust me. Like, it just kind of happened. Like when I broke my first world record, I was more concerned with where I was going for dinner. And my coach was like, it's a world record. And my dad's like, so hon, what do you want to do for dinner? I was like, I don't know. We're thinking like Chinese, we want to get Mexican. And then like that changed everything. And then everyone was like, oh my gosh, this teenager from New Hampshire is coming out the woods. And the press just had a field day with it. And so, there was a lot of things I just didn't align with my values and my views when it came to the Paralympics. And there was just a lot of things behind the scenes that were just not okay, and were a little, you know, politically driven. And so I think it got to a point where my integrity was being questioned, and that is not okay with me. And so it was affecting me in more ways than I was comfortable with. And I was like, this is not why I started swimming. I started swimming to give hope. I started swimming to give myself hope. And the fact that I could give other people hope. And then now that people are questioning my integrity because I'm training smarter, I'm swimming faster, is beyond insane. And it just took away that joy for me. And I think life is too short to not be, you know, around the people that give you joy, but also doing things that bring you joy. And so I think it was just the combination of the two. And it just got to a point where I was like, this isn't fun anymore. This is not, you know, breaking a record isn't, I don't get that joy anymore. And I don't get, you know, I feel like I'm in this, you know, this kind of game where people just want to keep tearing me down or questioning me. And I'm honest as can be, like, trust me. Like, and that was, I think, the hardest thing, is it came down to my integrity, which was what got me in this predicament in the first place when I was really sick with doctors, where they questioned my integrity. And I ended up losing many, many years of my life. And my whole life was altered because of that, and still is. And so I think it came down to that and being like, this is not okay. And this is not something I'm going to continue to put up with. And I think there are certain situations where when it is affecting you in more ways, you have to walk away. Was it easy? No. Would I have loved to? Absolutely. But what happened after that is far greater than winning another gold medal or winning more gold medals. Is I got set on a whole different path of not just for myself and walking and, you know, working and, you know, finding my career at ESPN, but also launching a foundation and helping people and taking this, terrific ordeal and doing some good with it. And so I think it, as disappointing as it was, it actually opened up that one door of swimming and sport, opened up by closing that, opened up so many more that I wouldn't change it.
You skipped over being able to walk again, as if it's, you know, going down the street to get the newspaper.
Well, that was my next like thing I did after swimming. I was just like, well, I'll show you people. Like,
yeah, exactly. And so again, this opinion of people, you allowed it to fuel you yet again. And November 11th, 2015, after working and working and working to get the movement back in your legs, you have your first muscle twitch in your leg. What do you think about in that moment? I couldn't imagine.
I thought back to when I started blinking for the first time. And I thought about how that simple movement, like changed everything. And so I just got so excited because I was like, the simple twitch is going to change everything. And so I just fanned the flame after that and just decided, all right, like, that's all I needed. Thank you. Let's go. And so, I was excited, but I was like, oh, I know what to do with this little flick, you know, like, let's do something with it and let's fan that flame.
But to get to that point, you had decided to go into, like, there was actually a bit of a business venture that you and your mom decided to go into business together to start a Project Walk that wasn't in the area. And so you went into business together. What if you and your mom, what it makes me think, where my mind goes, is what if you guys didn't believe? What if that hope wasn't there and you didn't start that business together and ultimately also source resources for you to get back to walking?
I think honestly, if we didn't have that hope, I wouldn't be here today. And so I think it was just taking that. And my parents, when I first was coming out of this and dealing with being in a wheelchair and stuff, I was devastated and confused. And why did this happen? And so my parents made a promise. They were like, we promise we will do everything to help you get back everything that was taken away from you. Like, we won't leave any stone unturned. And so when Project Walk came, like, my parents literally mortgaged the house, and they had an expert tell them, months prior, they were like, yeah. Then my mom was like, what are the chances? You know, because I asked point blank the doctor. My mom was with me. She's like, well, to be honest with you, it's not going to happen. And I definitely wouldn't mortgage the house trying to find ways for it to happen. And that's exactly what my parents did. And Project Walk opened up a door in a place, not just for me, but for a community that was relatively lost, because they don't give you a manual for being in a wheelchair. And so you're kind of just sent home and sent on your way. And so we realized just in our area alone how many people needed help. And so we realized this is like our way as a family to give back and help other people. And so, because we didn't have a lot of help when I was really sick. And so we wanted to change that for other families. And as a result, I was able to train there, you know, 6 hours a day, 7 days a week, and just kept going for it because I was like, this is the moment, this is the time, this is where it's at. But as a result, other people found their miracles too.
A beautiful example of, again, tying it into the hero's journey, this idea of connectedness, a little bit of Buddhism, but you know, when you realize we're all together and you help everyone else, ultimately you end up helping yourself as well. I think fascinating. One quote you had too, I want to know how often you reflect on what you've been through, because why do I train so hard? You said, and you've said it already, because I know what it's like to lose it all. And people usually say, you know, don't focus on the negative. I know there's a lot of psychology and you know, reflections and meditation on negatives that can actually be powerful, but a lot of people are against that. You know, always be optimistic, always. But what is your approach to that?
I think it's okay to cry. It's okay to have moments. I think we're all human. But I think the core value and the core you kind of anchor, if you will, should be gratitude and should be hope. But it's okay if your ship gets rocked a little bit. It's okay if the storms come, like let them come. But to know that you're anchored in that gratitude and you're anchored in that hope and perspective. I think for me, I mean, trust me, I'm very much human and have moments where I feel like, you know, the waves are crashing over. But I think I'll kind of sit back and have a moment of reflection or have a moment of gratitude. And that usually kind of resets the clock. Or I'll have little reminders. I'll have reminders. I feel like every day I wake up and I put my feet on the ground and I still can't feel the ground beneath my feet is a reminder for me. And or even just the whole nose scratching thing of how that I remember that so vividly of laying there and my nose itched so badly and I couldn't scratch it. And I remember thinking to myself, man, if I could scratch my nose one day, I would be the happiest little human. And so I had a moment like that the other day where I was extremely stressed. I had a lot of deadlines and things I needed to do. And I was like spinning out and I was like pacing. I like stopped and just like scratched my nose. And I was like almost apologized to younger Victoria and be like, I'm sorry. Like, yes, this is awesome. Like, this is cool. So I think it's okay to have those moments. I think you just can't stay in that like negative space. You have to eventually pull yourself out, or sometimes people will pull you out. I'm thankful to be surrounded by humans who are well versed to like recognize it and kind of help me. But I think, yeah, I think it's like finding that balance, but being okay with falling flat on your face, because you will get back up again. It's just when you stop trying to get up is when you fail.
I have to ask, because, and if I'm being completely honest, and for those listeners that know me personally would know this, when people ask me, you know, if you could be any hockey player, I skip over hockey players and go right to Michael Phelps. So I need to ask you what it was like on your first day on the job at ESPN. I love that you're already looking a little bit nervous. So what was that experience like doing your first day on the job, ESPN, and you're interviewing Michael Phelps?
It was insane. Like I had been given this incredible opportunity, had zero television experience, grew up, you know, idolizing Michael and cheering him on at the Olympics and stuff. And so I remember we went into our production meeting, and mind you, I'm the new kid on campus. I'm 20 years old. Like, I have no idea what the heck I'm doing. I just have a microphone. I have my notes. Like, I have no idea what's going on. And my producer just nonchalantly walks up to me and hands me the shot sheet. And I see, you know, Victoria Arlen interview with Michael Phelps. And I'm like, hey, Kevin, like, what is this? And he's like, oh, it's your shot sheet. Like, it's our first shoot today. And I'm like, yeah, but what? He's just like, I didn't know what to say. And he was like, yeah, you're interviewing Michael Phelps today. And I don't think Kevin fully, you know, my producer fully knew that this was like my real first day. I think they thought, oh, maybe she's done a little work. I had done work, like nothing, like literally knew nothing. If you look at that photo of me with Michael, he's holding it very professionally. I'm holding it like a lollipop. Like, I just have no idea what I'm doing. And so we go to work and so I'm kind of like, okay, like, this is cool. And like, it wasn't even that I was like starstruck with Michael. It's the fact that I was given, you know, this was a cast that I was a part of, and I was given this incredible interview opportunity with someone I grew up admiring. And so, but at the same time, like, it's Mike Phelps. And so we go in there, and I had my note, I had a little cheat sheet because I had no idea what I was doing. So I needed a little cheat sheet. I like broke it all down and all the lingo down and stuff. And it was really cool because he had obviously done his research on me and knew I was a swimmer and knew my story. So really kind of opened up the door for like a connection of being like, hey, like this is your first day. Like, I'm so excited for you. Like London and all these. So there was a lot of correlations and our coaches knew one another. So there was like the nerves were eased, but it was like funny because by the end of the interview, he's like chirping me for my cheat sheet and the fact that like, he's like having to help me navigate it. And it was funny. I was like, dude, it's my first day on the job. Like, I'm trying to figure out. He goes, I know, that's why I'm chirping you. And he goes, honestly, you're doing great. He's like, just keep it up. And so it was like funny because later on that week I interviewed him again. And I had another cheat sheet. He's like, really? We already met. You already interviewed me. Like, you don't need the cheat. I was like, I'm still new. I don't know what I'm doing. And so, but it was cool because I couldn't have thought of a more perfect, you know, first interview for someone who really like, really, you know, gave an incredible interview, but also was like, gave me some chirps at the end too, which was really, I appreciated just given I have three brothers. But yeah, it was crazy. You can't make this stuff up. And I remember being like my first day on the job and I'm interviewing Michael Phelps. Like, I was like, all right, like, let's do this. Like, it was just a very bizarre, bizarre thing, but something that I took a tremendous honor in that I was given that, you know, as a rookie, given that opportunity.
So cool. So cool. Now winding down, the next adventure you went on is Dancing with the Stars. When you're about to go on and you know, you have to dance, you know, you're able to move, you still don't have that feeling in your legs. In that moment, what is it that, are you finally able to sit back and enjoy it? Or is there a constant reflection of, holy smokes, how did I get here?
I think moments like that was a holy smoke moment. I remember, the first dance in particular, they did a montage of kind of briefly my story. And I remember I was standing out on, so we all watch what the viewers are watching for the first time in the ballroom. So I'm standing all by myself. My partner was stage left and he was going to come out as the song started and dance. And so I'm standing there and I'm watching this montage like unfold. And I'm watching myself in this vegetative state. And I remember it was the first time that I like had like a flashback. And I just remember being frozen and I'm standing there and I'm just back in that hospital bed. And I'm like shaking. And then I come back and I have this, like, I felt almost like an out of body experience. I come back and I'm in this pink fringy pan outfit. Like, and my partner's yelling at me. My partner Val's like, Victoria. Victoria, and he called me Arlen a lot. And he's like, Arlen. And I finally look and as the music was starting and he just yelled, he's like, let's go change the world. And I remember just like smiling in that moment. It was like, holy moly. Like, I'm here. I'm doing this. Like, let's do this. Like that. I'm not there anymore. I'm here. And so I have to dance for that girl, that little girl in that hospital bed, because there's probably other little Victorias in hospital beds watching right now. And so I remember just having that moment and then just starting to dance. Then afterwards being like, I didn't fall on national television. <I'm> so excited about that. And my family, you know, my brothers were watching back east and my parents as well. And we had kept our dance super secretive. So it starts off very sweet and gentle. And then just like beat drops and we take off. And it was cool to see, you know, no one was expecting that, but then to see there's a video of my brothers, and they're watching me like, oh, this is cool. And then it takes off. I'm like, what is she doing? Cause I'd only been walking for a year. So they're still like, I was still a bit wobbly. And so they're like, how is this happening? So it was cool. It was fun.
Yeah. As you talk about that reflection back to when you were in the hospital, like my mind goes to that your body is, and I wonder your opinion on this actually, is your mind and your thoughts are in a way, I know we're connected to our bodies, but in a way separate than our bodies, and our mind and our spirit and our beliefs are almost using our body as a vehicle to live. What comes to mind when I say that, I guess your thoughts and your mind utilize the body as a vehicle to kind of interact with the world?
I completely agree with that. I think it goes back to that gratitude that in one of the darkest moments of my life, I remember like I either cry or try in this moment. And so if I thought negatively, if I thought about listening to every single expert and doctor telling my family that she's never going to make it, that she'll never amount to anything. And, you know, maybe they'll get a couple of years of me in a vegetative state and that's at most. And that was constant for 4 years. And so for me, I was like, I can go down that path, but that path is really scary. That path equals death. That path is not something I want to embark on. And so having that shift in perspective and focusing on gratitude, even if my list was teeny tiny and I maybe had one or two things on there, that was a different perspective that ignited hope and that almost gave my body a fighting chance at something to fight for. And so I absolutely agree that your thoughts do control your vehicle, I think, but I think we get so caught up in our minds sometimes, and it happens to everyone, that you have to shift that. You have to be aware of that. And I was like, do I want to die? No. Will it happen? Yes. But I've got nothing to lose at this point to have hope for my future. Like if it gives me 3 days of dreaming about what I'm going to do when I'm older and then I die, that's fine. I had 3 great days of dreaming about my future. I think the moment you fail is when you stop, is when you just go down the other path, is then you've already set yourself down, going down. You just have to look up.
On that note, the last thing I'm curious about is your journey's been absolutely insane, for lack of a better term. What's next? Do you have things that you're allowed to say, or are these secrets? I'm sure you've got something on the go beyond ESPN and then Dancing with the Stars. What might be next?
Being able to find new ways and improve in the ways I'm already doing, and like helping people find their miracle and find that blink moment, if you will, has been really powerful for me. And then I wish I could talk about the other things. I can't quite yet. But I think for me, it's just continuing to grow and continuing to make the most of this second chance I've been given, and trying to leave the world a little bit better than it was, you know, the day before. And so I think those are the things, and just continuing to challenge myself and be better in every single way.
That brings us to the end of another Heroic Minds podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to keep the conversation going, as always, my email is in the description of the episode. So I encourage you to send me an email. And of course, again, check out Victoria's book. That link is also in the description of this episode. I'm Ben Finelli. This is the Heroic Minds podcast. We'll talk again soon.